This is Edge Cases, and Andrew Pontius has the night off, so I am apparently in charge here, and I have a guest speaker. His name is Kyle Sluter. He works at the Omni Group.
Hello.
Hello. He works on OmniFocus. I'm sorry, Omni Outliner. Well, isn't OmniFocus that's pretty much kind of Omni Outliner with a bunch of stuff bolted on anyway?
That's true for... It's more true for OmniFocus 1 than it is for the currently in test OmniFocus 2.
You see, if I were more of a little man, I would pull strings and try to get into that beta. I actually signed up for that beta, but it was just last week. I know that that queue is pretty deep, so I'm going to be a good person and wait my turn.
Yeah, it's we're doing a rolling test, right. So eventually you'll have a copy in your hands. Whether you've had to pay for it or not, that depends on how deep the list is.
There you go. And so I know that we have a list of topics for tonight. We do try to keep this to about 45 minutes. That usually is our max, but we like to keep it at 45 minutes or less. And I suspect our list of topics is probably larger than that, but we'll play it by ear. We'll see how it goes.
Okay.
And I suspect, if I understand correctly, I believe your first topic that you want to talk about was disassembly.
Yes. Having recently, or I guess ever since I started at Omni, kind of being thrown into the deep end of working on Omni Outliner at a time at which we had moved Outliner to the more modern technologies that were available with Core Animation and such starting in 10.5, but we hadn't shipped anything with that technology yet. It's always been kind of a learning as I go situation.
Oh, really? So my current version of Omni Outliner Pro doesn't have any Core Animation-y goodness to it?
Unless you're running the test release of Outliner 4, no.
Okay, I'm running the stable public release, whatever that is. So okay.
The public version of Outliner 3, I think, was released in the 10.2, 10.3 timeframe, the current version that's out there now. Obviously not the exact minor version that you're running right now. We don't support anything older than 10.6, I think, in the latest release of Outliner 3.
Just checked, I'm running 3.10.6.
Yeah, that's definitely not going to support OS 10.2 or OS 10.3. Right. Mm-hmm. But that's the set of technologies that were around when we released Outliner 3. And a lot of the time, Core Animation's nice. It's got all sorts of cool things. But the Mac has a lot of history behind its...
You're being charitable.
Oh, yeah. I'm speaking in public. I've got to be charitable. I'm being diplomatic because I know that there's tons of code that I write every day that somebody in a year or two is going to look back on and wonder what's going on. At least they have the source code.
Right. And that person in the future is probably you who's going to shout WTF at yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, that was certainly the case a couple days ago with some code that I'd written a month ago. So, yeah. And I can look at my own source code. I can't look at the source code for AppKit, which is 20 years of history. So I have, for quite a while, been a big fan of, if something doesn't make sense, to look at the disassembly and to understand the disassembly. And it turns out that because of the way that Objective-C compiles down to assembly, the assembly is a little bit verbose but very clear. Mm-hmm. You have to put the receiver and the selector in the first two positions for arguments on the stack or in registers or whatever. You have to, the calling convention is repetitive. You can see the blocks of code in assembly. Mm-hmm. And the GDB disassembler was okay. The biggest problem that I had with it was that it was using AT&T syntax, and I had been raised on Intel syntax, or quote-unquote raised. I didn't really have a whole lot of assembly experience, but all of the assembly experience that I did have was all with AT&T assembly, or Intel assembly. So that was the biggest hurdle. And then it was a couple of years ago.
And we should probably clear up what the differences between AT&T and Intel variants of assembly are.
Order of arguments is the big one. In Intel assembly, if you have an instruction like move, the destination comes first. Mm-hmm. And in AT&T syntax, the destination comes second. And there are a couple of other things that are different about them. Prefixing, or suffixing rather, oftentimes you'll just see move, and then the kind of move is implied by the arguments that are provided. So a move of a 64-bit register to a 64-bit register will just be MOV in Intel, or in most disassemblers that follow the Intel syntax, at least that I've seen. You'll have MOV and then the 64-bit sort, or a 64-bit destination and the 64-bit source. In AT&T syntax, as put out by GDB, you'll see it'll be move Q or some suffix that implies that it's a 64-bit move. So that's more information, but it's just there's a lot more S's and X's and Q's and L's and things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I believe this was looking through Xcode's preferences. I know that in Xcode 3, there was actually a pop-up menu for selecting which syntax you wanted. And I believe it defaulted to AT&T, which would match GDB.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think that that preference exists anymore. And
we're lucky to have a disassembler at all. Are you kidding?
Yeah. Well, so the LLDB disassembler, it's making advancements, but my preferred tool right now is Hopper, the Mac disassembler that pretty much everybody who does frequent disassembly on the Mac uses. I've seen Mike Ash loud its capabilities many times, and it iterates very fast, or at least it used to. I'm on the Mac App Store version, and I've heard from some people that I should not be using the Mac App Store version.
Yeah, I meant to clear this up before I got online with you, but I believe the Mac App Store version is somewhat frozen, and the Smarkle version is the one who's getting all the small updates, incremental updates. So, but we, I'll put a, if I find any blog entry on that, I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, that would definitely be helpful, because I am definitely still on the Mac App Store version, and I do get updates, or at least I have gotten updates relatively recently, but it sounds like I might be behind the times a little bit, but it, right now, the version of Hopper that I have on my machines will read 32 and 64-bit Intel assemblies, and it will read ARM assemblies. 32. Right. And I don't know if it'll do 64-bit ARM. But
is that really out in the wild too much right now, 64-bit ARM?
I don't think it's out in the wild.
I know there's like ARM servers coming online and stuff like that, but
yeah,
I don't think we have ARM. Any 64-bit ARM processors in our iPhones yet.
Mm. Am I misremembering? Does it only do PowerPC?
Which?
Hold on. I'm going to check myself before I give out misinformation. I almost exclusively use the 64-bit Intel option for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. But it'll also read Windows PE files. That's interesting. I didn't know that. But which is actually helpful, because EFI executables are Windows PE executables.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, if you're doing any sort of bootloader for machines that run EFI, of which the Intel Macs are one, right, then you're definitely going to have something that can produce a PE executable.
Okay.
So, yeah. Another trick that I like to use when I use the 32-bit libraries is the iOS simulator, because it's all 32-bit.
Oh, right.
Even though they're running on the modern runtime, which is an interesting feat.
Yeah, yeah. I just realized that is an interesting feat.
Yeah. But so I should probably back up. And oh wow, there's a lot of options here.
So it's a disassembler, right? Yeah.
Yeah, the disassembler is 32-bit, 64-bit Intel Mako. 32-bit. So I'm sorry. It says Mako 32 and 64-bit. Mako is the wrapper for executables. It doesn't necessarily imply that it's an Intel. And then 32 64-bit Windows PE, which it also doesn't imply what architectures, because PE can be used on Intel architectures or Alpha, I think Alpha, and perhaps even Spark and IA64, obviously, because you know there's probably someone somewhere who still has an Itanium machine sitting there doing some mission critical thing, and this machine can never be powered off. And then ARMv6, ARMv7, that's the distinction between ARM versions that I was thinking of.
Okay, there you go.
And three different variants of ELF. So it's also handy if you're doing Raspberry Pi stuff. But anyway.
So it sounds like that you're actually aiming Hopper at things like AppKit.
Yes, I normally that I have a permanently open disassembly of AppKit on my machine at work, at least. At home, I try not to work too much. But yes, there's a permanently open AppKit disassembly because there's a lot of things about AppKit that have changed in ways that are not documented, or that the documentation has never really been all that forthcoming. For those of you who out there who don't know how long Omni's been around, that's probably very few. But we have publications from the OpenStep days, and they go into details about the instance variables in OpenStep classes.
I remember in the bad old days of macOS 10 being bootstrapped, there was a website with some outdated OpenStep information, like when they did the Solaris port, and that was a gold mine right there. So yeah,
it's very useful information. Sometimes, like every so often, there's a nugget of information in the old OpenStep documentation that it explains why AppKit behaves a certain way.
Mm-hmm. I'll put a plug in that another. Resource which isn't directly Apple but is obviously related to Apple is Cocotron, which is basically a modern re-implementation of AppKit and Foundation and such, and it's non-viral, open source, and it's definitely not a one-to-one mapping to what's in AppKit. I mean the classes are all there, but it's written by volunteers, so you're not getting one-to-one. But if you nice thing, if you don't want to crack open a disassembler, you can go look at Cocotron, and you have some nice Objective-C source code there to try and figure out how this stuff could possibly even work if you want to get broad architectural strokes.
Yeah, it's the Cocotron's an amazing piece of work.
It is.
I haven't used it for anything yet, but speaking of Raspberry Pis, I have one, and I was looking at things I can do with it, and it looks like the Python bridges the Nokia Python, or I guess it's not Nokia anymore. Whatever holding company owns Qt now, they have their own Python bridge that seems to be kind of faltering.
Hmm.
So I was thinking, do I want to go with PyQt, which is a third-party Python library, or bridge rather, or do I want to consider Cocotron? Because Cocotron actually has an implementation of core animation.
Right.
But core animation was one thing that you can't really look at the disassembly for and get a lot of useful information about.
Mm.
But AppKit's bridge to core animation has been... I have mined that area of the disassembly very much.
Well, speak to why you don't get very much pleasure. I mean, not very much results from tearing apart core animation with Hopper.
It's all C++.
Oh, okay.
So you don't have the...
I imagine Hopper is demangling names nowadays.
Yeah, I...
But those symbols might not even be there, huh?
Yeah, it's really a matter of when you actually look at the function implementation. C++ code, after it's been compiled, has been transformed so much by the by template specialization and everything. So I am not a disassembly wizard, but... I take great advantage of how Objective-C code looks once it's been compiled.
Sure.
And every so often, blocks are another thing that are kind of confusing. They follow a pattern, but they are kind of Byzantine following out.
Yeah, it's really weird how they do the trampoline stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But so the blocks and the interfacing between core animation and AppKit views, those are two places that I've spent a lot of time in the disassembler for... well, I guess for the main view that you can see right now, it's been released in OmniPlan 2.0 and later, and is currently out in test for OmniOutliner 4, mm-hmm. And not in OmniFocus 2. But even though that works to originally started for OmniFocus, it's kind of interesting how that worked out. But that and iCloud/. The persistent document model that was introduced with 10.7,
sure,
which is incredibly blocky.
Yeah.
So those are where I really honed my disassembly skills, because there were a lot of question marks that those two technologies brought with them. And there were many radars that were filed, but I always try to be as precise and correct as possible in my radars, because more than likely they're not going to come back to me with a workaround, you know, right off the bat. So having my own workaround, or at least understanding what's going on, makes it a lot easier for all of us to just get it down on paper and move on.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the Hopper, I really, really enjoy working with Hopper. I like the fact that it will, unlike the LLDB disassembler, it will actually mark where selectors are referenced.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see if you load up some code in the LLDB disassembler, or if you wind up there by accident, which every so often I see somebody who is trying to figure out why they're looking at disassembly in Xcode 4.
Mm-hmm.
Or on the flip side, they're not looking at disassembly and they're trying to figure out why, because they would have in Xcode 3. And there's that little slider at the bottom of the debug navigator that show that controls how expanded that stack is.
Mm-hmm.
And when you create a new workspace, I think, it defaults to the middle, which is collapse contiguous frames that are not in my own code.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Xcode will try to find the nearest source file when it stops because of a crash or something. It will try to find the nearest source file on the stack or for a frame on the stack. So that's where you want to go to expand it all the way out, so you're seeing all the frames in the stack, including all the system frames. And be aware that if you're looking at your own code, you've just stopped in the debugger, you might not actually, that might not be the frame that you're actually stopped in. So when you wind up in disassembly, in LLDB disassembly, in Xcode 4 or in LLDB on the command line, they don't do a lot of dereferencing of symbols. You'll wind up with three columns or four columns, the offset into the method, and or there might be absolute translated addresses. And then the actual instruction, and then you'll sometimes have comments like, oh yeah, this is a reference to symbol some, you know, __ start plus some really crazy long number.
Mm-hmm.
If you are looking in Hopper instead, it will actually dereference those symbols into selectors or into class names or things like that. Or Cold Fusion. Wow. I just substituted CF into Cold Fusion in my brain instead
of Foundation. That's very impressive. Nice hash collision.
Yeah. That's an imperfect hash if I've ever heard one. but yes, that... It'll dereference a lot of those things for you. So
We should be clear that LLDB is when your process is live, when it's actually running, you set a breakpoint or crash or whatever, you have a live process, where right. Hopper is a static file analysis tool.
Yes, and the biggest conflict between switching between the two for me is that because it's a static file, all of the addresses in that Hopper shows are relative to zero, because it's not loaded into memory. Mm-hmm. So it's relative to the beginning of the text section or beginning of the file. Once the file's been loaded into memory, the linker has put it, or the dynamic loader has put it somewhere in memory. All of the addresses, like this instruction might exist, 61168C is one that I actually happen to be looking at right now, is in the middle of NSTextView dragging session ended to point operation. And you've got that number there, but that number's never going to show up in the live disassembly that LLDB is going to show you, because the app is currently running and the AppKit has been loaded at some address greater than zero, because zero is where the kernel is.
Hmm.
So, or I guess not in virtual space,
right,
but somewhere after 0x7F something or other. There's all sorts of things. If you really want the nitty gritty, there's the ABI documentation.
Yeah, that's actually one of the questions I had for you. So if you were talking about, you did Intel syntax before, so it sounds like you have a deep history of assembly.
Not that deep. I guess the history is not that deep. I've dug deep into the calling conventions and the way that OS X puts things in there, but that's because you have to. I mean, I've dug as deep as I have to, and you can't be very shallow with it because you won't understand what's going on.
But it sounds like it was x86-64 that you got started with, or?
Yeah, 32-bit.
Okay, so i386 or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I'm fairly young, so I started kind of late, and we did, in my undergrad, we did some, just in the couple of computer engineering classes, related classes, and I mean classes, not as in days of study, not semesters of a study. We covered Intel assembly because that's what we had. We had Intel machines. But then once I started needing to understand why, know, why is AppKit calling this method? Well, I've got this big morass of assembly in front of me.
Mm-hmm. And so now, this is one of the things that often I people who don't have the assembly or assembly background, they kind of, you know, it's they look at the assembly and their eyes just glaze over and they think it's totally incomprehensible and they don't even try start. And right. really the rules are pretty simple. You mentioned there's these things called the ABI or the Application Binary Interface. Mm-hmm. And there's a, so you probably worked, I think both Apple and Apple has a HTML page on their calling conventions, but it's pretty much, then I think they point to, I think it's oddly off like Red Hat or something like that, that has another x86-64. PDF that I tend to use, although I pretty much have jotted all that down into an Eagle Filer note that kind of shorthand, because these documents can get kind of large. But the it's a simple mapping. In these machines, they have stack pointers, they have registers, and when you want to call something, things have to go in a certain way, in a certain order. And that's all these documents do, is that they say, this goes here when this happens. Yep. And this is where you find your stack pointer, or this is how, whatever. And then after that, just you're moving things around, you're adding things, you're jumping things. Once you learn, I would say maybe 8 commands, like x86 instructions, you can read probably 90% of assembly out there.
Yeah,
and so then you shouldn't be scared.
Yeah, it's not a scary thing. But then you have there are layers on top of it, right? There's layers of abstraction on top of that.
Sure.
Once you understand how assembly works, it's very simple, just verbose. Then you have to be able to translate that into, you know, because you're almost certainly not working in assembly yourself.
Right.
So you're trying to translate it into, what does this objective C code that has been translated into assembly, what is that doing? What's mm-hmm. the logic here? Mm-hmm. And then that part is where learning how the objective C language works is important. So once you've mastered, or you could actually do it in either order.
Yeah.
Like you can learn how Objective-C gets translated into C, mm-hmm. and then how C gets translated into assembly, mm-hmm. and then learn how the assembly for your particular platform works. Or you can start at the bottom end and work your way up.
Yeah. Fortunately for us, how Objective-C maps onto C is pretty straightforward. And yep. And fortunately for us, also, it tends to be kind of stringy in terms of how selectors are stored in the Mako binary. Yeah. And so that helps a lot when you're looking at things in Hopper or LLDB for kind of providing roadmaps to where you jump if you actually took this instruction.
Exactly. Yeah, everything's kind of laid out there for you, and Hopper is very good about seeing the places where those references are made to selectors or whatever, and just putting the user-understandable value right there in a comment next to the line of assembly that is actually making the call. Mm-hmm. But you'll notice after a while that, okay, we're loading the receiver into RDI. Mm-hmm. We're loading the selector that we're going to pass or we're going to invoke into RSI. And then we call Objective-C message send. And you'll see that triple all over the place. And eventually your brain will just start. It's like the Matrix. Lon Brunette message send. But blocks are just... Blocks are bad enough when you're dealing with them in high-level languages. Just trying to deal with them in assembly is terrifying. Like, that's something that I don't wish on my worst enemies, is trying to navigate the twisty maze of blocks that happens during document saving. And this document is very blocky.
So it sounds like that you already had a background of disassembly and assembly before you were using Hopper, but it sounds like you probably started using Anchor in order to get a handle on the core animation stuff?
That and document saving kind of at the same time. I think there was a bug that surfaced sometime soon after I got hired, and it's just kind of one of those things like, why is my layer not matching up with my view, sort of thing. And that started me down on this path of these really, really long posts to the Cocoa Dev mailing lists that are like, here is the 7 steps that you need to take in order to get this to malfunction. And here's what we tried, and here's what we figured out that AppKit's doing. Why is AppKit doing this? Blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, no response. But we have filed numerous bugs, and we've gotten responses on the bugs. Turns out that if you use an official bug reporting channel, you're more likely to get a response. But, so that was the that was the impetus. Was I think it was dealing with flipped views that are layer backed, and how 10.7 earlier didn't really deal with that correctly.
So I mean, it seems like the APIs was pretty stable between when the when the layer backed views and layer hosted views came online, and well, I guess that was 10.6. And but underneath the hood, apparently there's been significant changes.
There has been a lot of changes for 10.8, and they're all very good changes.
Okay.
And I want to thank everybody at Apple who's been working on that. I know of a couple people, one or two people I know of have been working on that, but I'm sure there have been more.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a that was bringing 10.8 basically more in line with the way that iOS does.
Yeah, I believe that we talked a little bit about this before. You said UI view, I give myself away. NS view animation uses core animation circa 10.8, or was that actually land later? I mean earlier.
So there are certain circumstances on 10.7 and earlier where you can do an animation using the NS view animator proxy,
mm-hmm.
and it will actually use core animation to drive that animation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's much easier to get that configuration working in 10.8.
Okay. So you basically have to be on the golden path for that to work. But it sounds like that golden path has gotten wider on 10.8.
Yeah. The big complicated thing about working with layers on 10.8 or on 10.7 and earlier was knowing when to update your contents.
Hmm.
The old way of doing things with DrawRect and everything, that all was translated for you by what is internally called layer kit glue.
Mm-hmm.
But the layer backing, that's what in the documentation is referred to as layer backing, which is the glue code that makes DrawRect work.
Yeah, so
let's
first define our terms here. So there's obviously there used to be this thing called LayerKit, but it actually shipped as core animation.
Yeah.
And then you have the old, when you were talking about AppKit, the 20-year-old view system, that's our good friend NSView.
Mm-hmm.
And circa 10.6, Apple said, oh, look, we have this new way of doing things. And you can use core animation directly. Or you can do these things called layer-backed or layer-hosted views. And that's when your NSView will use the new core animation system underneath.
Right.
And the difference between layer-backed and layer-hosted is layer-backed is you're not supposed to touch the layer, that you can use kind of like it was basically a caching mechanism for your draw recs, and just kind of hands-off type thing. If you're layer-hosted, then you can touch the layers. One of the tricky points for me is that I was very confused of which one was which, and it's very subtle, the difference in just how you create your NSView, and you say the order of calls you make, makes this very big difference of whether it's layer backed or layer hosted.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed really subtle for such an important distinction.
And we have this kind of hybrid beast in the main views for Outliner 4 and for OmniPlan 2, one of the side effects of this whole layer backing, layer hosting distinction is that once you have a layer hosting view,
mm-hmm.
that has its own custom view, you're not supposed to add subviews to it.
Right.
Because those expect to have an AppKit managed layer tree above them. But we need field editors.
Right.
Because OS X still has this concept of you click in a text field and this shared NS text view instance that currently is off screen gets blatted into place where the text field was, and then it starts editing there. And our text fields are all our own custom rendering,
mm-hmm.
Which that was also a pain in the neck. And I can't take credit for pushing this one. Tim Wood, I think, is the CTO of Omni, is the one who either discovered or asked the right questions in order to figure out how to get correct subpixel anti-aliasing,
right,
in a layer-backed or a CA layer, even when you draw it by yourself.
Right, right. Let me tell you, that golden path is pretty narrow too.
Oh yeah, once you have all the pieces in place, it makes sense why, but you shouldn't have to put them in place yourself. I don't think it's a matter of when you create your own layer, you have to give it a bitmap context and tell the bitmap context your bitmap format is in the format that makes sense for the native machine,
mm-hmm.
and it has to be 32-bit color.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was a long time coming. But once you've got all that set up, right, we do all that custom, and that's all on custom CA layers. We have this big tree of CA layers in this view. But we want to stick a regular NS text view in there when we start editing. So we actually have two views that live side by side, mm-hmm. or one on top of the other. And one of them is transparent layer-backed view that we add field editors to, mm-hmm. and one of them is a full custom CA layer tree.
Okay.
And so we play with that line a lot. we dance across both sides of that line, and that's been a source of confusion at times. I still don't particularly think that the line between a layer backed and a layer hosting view is all that clear. Mm-hmm. And my poking and prodding with Hopper has revealed that there really is not all that much different about them anymore.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I've run into thing where things that supposedly shouldn't have worked with layer backed views do, and that gives me a false sense of security, I know.
Yeah, it's really more of a we don't promise that things are going to work.
Right.
But it just, the natural implementation is that they will work,
right,
because of the way they're implemented. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's don't expect anything to work. Really. I guess trust but verify.
Does this mean that OmniOutliner is going to target 10.8 exclusively, or you're going to have to work in the 10.7 context as well?
I don't have anything to say about that.
Okay.
I can say that our current test version requires 10.8.
Okay.
But that doesn't necessarily reflect anything about the final shipping product.
Sure.
I don't make those kinds of calls. I just write the code. I certainly have input into those kinds of calls, but there I can definitely say that the 10.8 support for layer backing is far superior. So anyway, getting back to the whole reason why it's superior, as we'd mentioned that before, there's the whole support for your custom draw rect or your normal NSV draw rect stuff. And that's still there, and it draws into layers and everything for you. But you don't know really, you don't control when that happens. The window invalidates itself. You tell the window, hey, I'm sorry, you do control when that happens by invalidating your regions. But if you do custom layer drawing, prior to 10.8, there was no real good way of telling the window, hey, I need to update this layer when all the other layers in the window need to be updated. You know, batch all these requests together and tell all the layers to update. 10.8 has this new wants update layer method that you can return yes from, and then it will send you layout, like the auto layout method layout.
Right.
Even though you don't actually have to be doing auto layout, which I think is a bit of a mistake, kind of overloading those methods. But mm-hmm. But that's where you would. It's the equivalent of layout subviews, essentially, on iOS. So it gives you more of a pass, like a one pass layout kind of thing. And it's interesting to me, and I've never worked on virtual or terminal software or anything like that, VT100s or anything, but it's interesting how we're getting closer and closer to that kind of setup where you have this one pass for this, one pass for this, one pass for this, top to bottom in the window, rather than when I first started doing Mac programming around the 10.4 timeframe and bindings was the new hot thing.
Mm-hmm.
Things were getting updated just kind of all over the place.
Right.
And like views and widgets would be updated with the new value that they needed, and they would, you know, signify that they needed drawing or whatever. And drawing still happened in one pass from the root of the tree down. But
right,
all the updates and the values, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the resurgence of, or not the resurgence, but the interest around MVVM, I think in part is a reaction to that. The recent, and I don't really grok MVVM like I do some of the other stuff that's in Cocoa, but it seems to me like the ability to batch up your view state and then apply it to your view in a more structured manner seems to be a bit of a reaction to the whole laissez-faire, you know, this model object over here changed, so we're going to push that change all the way through to the view.
Mm-hmm. It was a very interesting technical decision that that KVO is synchronous.
Yeah.
You probably heard of Sprout Core, which has now morphed into Ember, JS. Right. And they also have a KVO system, very, very much modeled on Cocos KVO. And for efficiency reasons, that's asynchronous. And it seems like most of the kind of the observing type of technologies there are asynchronous, primarily so you can batch those updates. So, yeah.
I'm surprised that it's more efficient to be asynchronous in that regard. Do they just run a timer?
You get a timer kind of just in terms of how events are dispatched on web pages. Kind of get that for free, but yeah.
Oh, okay, I see. So you're just piggybacking off of that.
Yeah. You basically build a queue of changes so that when your stack unwinds, you can then throw out all the redundant changes and just do those. Because touching the DOM is expensive.
Yeah. So you just send a new page?
It depends on what, usually you're just updating divs or whatever.
Mm.
But you only want to update the div with the final value instead of all the intermediate values.
Yeah, I guess the most expensive thing about updating a view in OS X is the drawing.
Right.
Almost always. And unless you're doing it way too much. So it's cheap to push a new string value to a text field and three different string values before you draw.
Sure.
But our apps tend to do a lot of computation. So we make use of KVO. But for example, in Outliner, you can have a summary on a column, and it can calculate sums and everything. And sums are not, you know, they're not complicated to compute. But something like OmniPlan's leveling, or things like that, those are a lot more complicated. So we do our own batching in where it makes sense. But definitely, KVO encourages you to push all those changes all the way through to the view.
Yeah, I actually have a tweet from you I want to mention. You said, lately, and I'm quoting you here, lately I've been coming to the conclusion that model controller KVO is fine, but controller view KVO is abhorrent.
Yes.
So I don't understand what you mean by that.
So I guess what it really means is that, so we use KVO from the model because it presents a uniform interface for changes. Whether those changes come from the view or they come from AppleScript or from loading a new file or from synchronizing the document with a server or something like that. Right, all
it's,
those things.
It's fine grained notifications.
Right. And that works great. And then controllers, their natural role is to kind of coalesce those changes and update the view. Particularly in the way that Coco works, they kind of act as that sort of push the model to the view sort of thing, and then the view gets the input and pushes that back to the controller, and the controller pushes that back down to the model, rather than some other implementations where all the input goes into the controller, and the views are very dumb. And it's having that final link where a model change immediately influences the view can really be troublesome,
right?
Because you have to build all that batching infrastructure into the view now. If the view is particularly complex, if you've ever bound an NS outline view to an NS tree controller, aside from NS tree controller being broken, there's so much stuff that NS outline view has to do to make sure that it doesn't reorder things in the wrong way. That if nodes drop or move, say you drop the parent of a node and move its children to somewhere else. It needs to compute all those changes, and all that has to live in the view. Whereas in the model, or if you put that logic in the controller, then you can the view can be a lot dumber. Especially if you are doing sorting or other kind of, if your controller and your view both have to have logic, then you either need to more tightly couple your view to your controller, or you need to copy paste some code. And if you break the second link in that chain from the model to the view in terms of KVO, then you can get away with not putting that logic in the view. And having it in the controller might make the controller slightly more complicated, because now it not only has to do the work of coordinating between a bunch of model objects, but it also has to simplify those changes and push them to the view. But I think that that's probably a better way of going about it. And I think that philosophy is reflected more so in iOS than it is on the Mac, partially because iOS doesn't have bindings. But you can just see the bias in UI table view controller for having the controller set up a cell and just plop the values into the subviews of that cell. And then the table view takes responsibility of putting the cell in the view. That bias was brought back to the Mac with view-based table views in 10.7. all the sample code out there from Apple doesn't suggest that you bind your views in your subviews of your cell view to the controller via the object value property. Mm-hmm. It recommends that your controller create dequeue the cell from the queue or the reuse queue, or by creating it from nib or whatever, and then plopping the view state into the views, and then just having them disconnected. Also animations are a big problem here. Say you're getting rid of this is actually a bug that I think Omniplan had, where a view would get a row would get dropped, and we would remove all of the model objects immediately. Mm-hmm. And that change would propagate all the way to the view. Mm-hmm. While that row was being animated off screen. Mm. So all of the things would get like parentheses null, or they would go empty as the thing was fading out. So I think that in general, I think that binding all the way from the model to the view presents a lot of problems.
I would, I would think that depending on the animation, and I would almost think that it would work by accident with all the caching that Core Animation does, that it would like render the snapshot before it got dropped into some OpenGL buffer, and then it does end up, even though it was technically incorrect that that row had been dropped and you should be showing nulls, that it's just cached away and it would happily animate that. But
well, you have to write, because you have to write that code to tell Core Animation or to tell NS Window that it should tell your layers to update themselves, then you have to put that logic in those layers, right? Okay. You have to, or in the view that's managing those layers, to say, oh, I heard about this change, but I should ignore it. I shouldn't invalidate my Core Animation caches. Mm-hmm. Core Animation is dumb, right? Yeah. It's dumb in terms of understanding your model. It doesn't know that your model needs to change whenever the value is associated with a change. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that it would be, people would be more likely to wind up in that trap if there were key paths or values affecting needs to display thingy-mabobber, or if people were putting their model values directly in as properties on their CA layers, and because CA layers are infinitely extendable key value coding collections, then they would notice that needed to display whenever such and such property changed. But people don't tend to do that. People put them on the views, but for some reason they haven't started putting them on the layers yet. So Core Animation can be, it's easy to make Core Animation not invalidate its layers. Mm-hmm. But if you're doing the so naive thing, right, where the view notices that its model has changed, or the value coming from its controller has changed, and it updates itself with a new value, all of a sudden you got to put special casing. Well, is my model object going away? So you have all these if model object invalid, or if not model object invalid, then self layer set needs display yes, blah, blah, blah. So just more ifs that don't need to be written if all of that logic is collected in the controller.
We're getting towards the end here, and I've been asking a lot of questions and kind of pointing out things. So I know that you probably had an outline in mind. So was there anything else you wanted to talk about Hopper or Core Animation-y type stuff?
Not particularly. I do want to I just want to say that auto layout is another big topic of mine.
That is the top posting on your blog, and yeah. I purposely did not bring it up because I figured that is basically a show in itself.
That is totally a show in itself, and it interacts with auto layout or with Core Animation in some interesting ways.
So does Omni Outliner 4 use auto layout?
Yes, actually, Outliner 4 and Focus 2 both use auto layout for the sidebar.
Okay,
which was shown off in our. In our demo event for OmniFocus, our debut event for OmniFocus 2. I'm kind of proud of all the auto layout magic that's going on in there. It took me a long time to understand it, but that's one of those things that you go depth first on and you really gain a lot of insight into.
Yeah, I don't know how long it took you, but it took me about, I would say, 2.5 days before I could actually do the things I wanted to do in it. And that was me working on it full time.
That sidebar is a lot more.
Oh, sure. I'm just talking about auto layout.
Oh, yeah. No, getting it to actually do anything. Yeah. Days is definitely the right scale, and plural is definitely required there. But yeah, that sidebar was a lot of work, but we got a lot of radars out of it, and a lot of institutional knowledge and a lot of good prepping for the future. But the way that 10.8, pay attention, if you're doing anything with auto layout, pay attention to how and when NSView has decided that your layer needs to be redrawn. Pay attention to the layer contents redraw policy. Pay attention to implicit animations, which are a new thing in 10.8, where you can actually tell the current NS animation context whether it should create core animation animations for all of the changes that happen. Because that's the preferable way to get your user interface to animate now, based in response to changes in its views. So you'll set up all your constraints, right? And then maybe you'll add a new view in there. And the layout system will compute new frames. And it will only animate those changes, the changed frames, if certain conditions are met with your layers. And it's easier to meet those conditions now in 10.8. But in order to understand what those conditions are, you're going to definitely want to read the AppKit release notes.
Right. That's always such a gold mine.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people don't know they exist. The AppKit release notes are considered official documentation by the documentation team. So if a question that you have is not answered in the document, in the main documentation, what most people would think of as the whole documentation, check the release notes, because there's oftentimes a lot of really valuable, important information there, and they just don't get around to moving that information back to the main release notes. And that document explains the conditions under which AppKit will be able to animate your view using core animation. And that's important if you're trying to get animated results from auto layout. If you're not explicitly yourself creating NSView animations or creating an NS animation context and setting the implicitly animatable property and creating NS animation or CA animations within that or whatever, understanding that. That's all I really needed to say about auto layout.
You mentioned the AppKit release notes. I realize that, to my knowledge, they still haven't documented the magical golden path that you need to be on to get anti-alias texts there, right?
Yeah, you're probably right.
I seem to remember, you know, whenever I have to Google the information to pull it up, it's usually buried in a CocoDev post.
I get to look at the source code. So. Oh, speaking of source code,
yeah.
People out there should know that Omni publishes
a
lot of our own frameworks. You can get those things off of GitHub at github.com/omnigroup. We do take pull requests, and we appreciate them when they come in. So please do check out our source code and see, obey the license. It's a very, very accommodating license.
There is, delve deeply into the Omni Group public source repository, and there is tons and tons of stuff in there. And as a kind of, you know, it should be, because Omni Group has been running Next software and Mac software and now iOS software for a very long time, and it's very deep. And I probably could just spend a year thus blogging the classes and why they exist and how they interact, because there's tons of stuff there. So it's definitely worth checking out. It'd be like swallowing a whale going in. So I would recommend kind of doing focus attempts at navigating the source code. But
they look at the thing that whose name suggests that it might be helpful for your current problem. And then just follow the imports from there, because you'll probably wind up exploring the entire source tree at that point, but at least you'll have a starting point.
Right. And it is structured in terms of like a hierarchy of frameworks kind of layered on top of each other. So there's the Omni base at the very bottom, Omni foundation above that, and then you get the Omni AppKit type stuff and so forth.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a very nice resource.
Okay. Then we should probably mention you're on Twitter under opt shift K. That's OptShiftK.
Go type that into the text edit. Or use the command keys or the modifier keys, and you'll see why.
Oh, I knew it. I knew it immediately. That was one of the first things that enamored me with the Mac back when I had still have it, but my 128K Mac. The idea that you could make a little... Oh, I won't give it away although I suspect our audience probably already knows the secret.
Yeah.
But we'll, you have a blog under a similar name, in fact, the same name, at www.opshiftk.com.
Yep.
And I guess that about wraps it up. Our show page is at edgecasesshow.com. Thanks for coming on EdgeCases, Kyle.
Thank you for having me, Wolf.